Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on The Conversation. It's Aloha Friday, June 5th. We check in with the new leader of the Nature Conservancy's Pacific region, Palau's own Kebi Sakuma. A film tells the story behind the first Micronesian woman to explore the deepest part of the Pacific Ocean, the Marianas Trench. Poems from a Marshallese daughter, a Pacific Island poet, sits down with us to talk about climate change. And we talk to Chamorro writer and environmental lawyer Julian Uggan about his journey and desire to build community across the Pacific and the world.
Support for HPR comes from Ala Moana Hotel by Mantra, featuring reimagined rooms crafted with island-inspired style and new furniture and lighting. Kama'aina reservations at alamoanahotel.com.
Tune in to HPR2 this Sunday at 3 p.m. as Hawaii Symphony Concertmaster Iggy Jang and international piano virtuoso Jeremy Denk share duties as conductors and performers. We'll hear Ravel's Mother Goose Suite, Haydn's Symphony No. 83, The Hen, and Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 25. That's this Sunday at 3 p.m. on HPR2, sponsored by the Rice Partnership.
Support for HPR comes from the Hawaii Employers Council's annual Talent Summit, June 26th at the Ala Moana Hotel, bringing together stakeholders to address workforce challenges. Registration at hecouncil.org.
You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Severe weather is on our minds. The National Weather Service predicts an above-normal hurricane season in the Central Pacific, and our neighbors to the west are still reeling from the effects of Super Typhoon Sinlaku. The storm pummeled the Northern Mariana Islands, Guam, and Chuuk in April of this year. In May, we heard from the new regional leader at a global environmental nonprofit. Keobel, or Kebi Sakuma, was recently named the executive director of the Nature Conservancy's Micronesia and Polynesia chapter. Sakuma is based out of Palau, where he spent years working for the Palauan government, and he helped create and lead the Palau National Marine Sanctuary. Sakuma spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about his priorities for land and marine conservation in the region, starting with recovery from a storm whose devastation he calls eye-opening.
We are deeply involved in the resilience efforts, the sustainability efforts, and now the recovery efforts of the islands. And the Nature Conservancy recently contributed to the recovery and cleanup in Chuuk. But it's not a one-off event. These storms are happening more and more, not necessarily in a vacuum. They're happening more and more repeatedly across the region. And the effects of climate change can be felt in our region in a way that is not detached. We see sea level rise inundating our lands, our crops, and we see more frequent storm activity. And the fact that our countries, our islands, really don't contribute to the overall problem of climate change in terms of carbon emissions, but are feeling the firsthand effects, is obviously not fair, but is also an issue that we need to plan for in the future with adaptation. You know, a lot of the islands that we work in are low-lying atolls. The Marshall Islands are all low-lying atolls, and king tides with storm activity are just devastating to these atolls and really affect their ability to farm, to fish, and to feed the communities and the families there.
I think your point is well taken, that these are islands that have been disproportionately affected by climate change. You'll hear the statistic that Micronesia is losing land to sea level rise 3 times faster than the rest of the world. So while people might talk about climate change in hypothetical future tense, it's a reality in parts of Polynesia and Micronesia. But I wonder specifically with the effects of the super typhoon, how has it affected some of the priority areas that you have at the Nature Conservancy? What are kind of the areas that you're keeping an eye on right now?
Yeah, well, our chapter, our program here really has identified a specific strategy in which we can best support our communities, our governments, and our people. And those strategies center around ocean recovery and island resilience. The people that live in our region are heavily dependent on coastal fisheries, coral reefs, and the ability to farm and fish the lands and oceans that we've been doing for millennia and over generations. That is the underlying driver for everything we do in the Pacific. And when storms like Sinlaku come and devastate these islands, it sets us back years. And in fact, even the ongoing rehabilitation and recovery of these islands need to be done in a very careful way. We don't want to have invasive species be introduced by, say, tractors or, you know, all the heavy equipment coming in and participating in these recovery efforts. But, you know, first and foremost are the livelihoods of the people. They're directly tied with the environment and protecting the corals, creating management programs for coastal fisheries and allowing fishers alternative access to other forms of fishing, creating marine protected areas and looking at it from not only a scientific approach, but a sustainability approach is, I think, essential in our region to make sure that, you know, conservation isn't done for conservation's sake alone, but really to ensure the sustainability and livelihoods of our Pacific people into the future. One innovative approach that I would like to touch on is within our region is the Micronesia Challenge. And it's a commitment made by the three sovereign nations, Palau, FSM, and RMI, or Marshall Islands, Guam, and CNMI, to effectively conserve 30% of their marine resources and 30% of their terrestrial resources, as well as effectively manage their entire ocean space, or EEZ. And this was set in motion back in 2006. This commitment really stood the test of time because it's based in the tradition of conservation from our people. And it has been taken on by the countries, the communities, and has really become a sense of pride in the international and global conservation arena as a model for the bottom-up approach, you know, beginning with communities, people, and really seeing what their priorities are, what their traditional methods of conservation were, and then using science and the resources brought by organizations like the Nature Conservancy to support that initiative. And back in 2006, the Nature Conservancy was a founding contributor to the Micronesia Challenge, which has only grown since then. And in fact, recently, there is a renewed effort to fully finance the Micronesia Challenge through what we call a Project Finance for Permanence, which is a funding approach that identifies a large area of very important biodiversity like the Micronesia region, and then brings together public and private financing to effectively fund all the conservation efforts, the marine protected areas, the ridge to reef programs, the coral restoration, the fisheries work, to effectively finance that in perpetuity through a conservation trust fund. And in our case, it's the Micronesia Conservation Trust. It's a very innovative approach. It's not a short process. There are many different stages, but the fact that this approach brings in millions to effectively conserve and manage those areas makes it very worthwhile, and also makes it a little bit of a longer process, because we really want to identify every need, whether it's technical or financial, and every target and every marine protected area or coral restoration area that needs this particular funding, whether it be through the Protected Areas Network or another avenue, and have a single close where we bring all the fundraisers, all the funding sources together, identify the need, and then bring that that resource to the Conservation Trust Fund, which will in turn fund or finance these interventions in perpetuity.
I really hope that listeners' eyes don't glaze over when we talk about innovative funding mechanisms for conservation, because it really is so important right now. And it seems like the Nature Conservancy is on the cutting edge with public-private partnerships, with the idea of ensuring coral reefs, and especially in a conservation funding landscape that isn't as friendly as it's been. It's critical that you identify ways to fund these projects for the immediate and long-term future.
Yeah, no, you're right. And I sometimes kind of lose sight of the fact that it might only be me and a few select others that get excited about sustainable financing mechanisms and funding sources for conservation. But, you know, the fact is, these efforts do take resources. You know, on the ground, in order to effectively manage a marine protected area, you need enforcement, you need management plans, you need, you know, scientists to go out there and monitor coral reefs. You know, you need innovative, out-of-the-box solutions for problems that aren't necessarily really relevant in the Western context. So a good example is a program called Pacific Island Tuna that the Nature Conservancy started with the Marshall Islands to access or to participate more in the tuna fishing industry in the Pacific, which is over a $3 billion a year industry, in which the countries who own the resources only get a fraction of that that revenue. So these out-of-the-box ideas and programs, whether they're successful or not, you know, we really have to take them on in order to meet these challenges that we're seeing in this new kind of global environment.
Any other priorities coming in as executive director of Micronesia and Polynesia? I know you've been with the Nature Conservancy for a while, so it really is just a next step in your career.
Well, yeah, no, I think it's definitely not lost on me that that our chapter or our business unit is different than a lot of the other chapters within the Nature Conservancy, and different than a lot of other programs in other NGOs, merely because of the fact that our chapter includes three independent countries, four associated territories with the U.S. and with France, and the sheer space, the sheer size of the area that's under our jurisdiction is, you know, just to give context, it's larger than the continental U.S. It stretches from the Marshall Islands to Palau, down to French Polynesia, up to the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas. And this presents a lot of challenges in organizing people, organizing programs, challenges in culture, challenges in language. But, you know, it also represents a huge opportunity to bring these like-minded communities and stakeholders together to meet the challenges of climate change, to meet the challenges of overfishing, to meet the challenges of invasive species. And I think one thing that every Pacific Islander would agree to is that, you know, you go further when you go together. You know, paddling the canoe in the same way is the only way you're going to get to your destination. And building on that collaboration, that historic culture of participation and cooperation is the only way that we're going to achieve what we're trying to achieve and meet those goals that we're trying to meet and ensure that our people are at the forefront and have a voice in the discussions that are happening about conservation, about resource management, and about the future of our globe.
That was KB Sukuma of the Nature Conservancy and HPR's Maddie Bender. To learn more about the Nature Conservancy's work in Micronesia and Polynesia, head to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaiian Airlines, serving the islands for more than 95 years and committed to connecting Hawaii with the world for generations to come. Learn more at hawaiianairlines.com.
Aloha, I'm Bert Lum. If you're interested in science, technology, and Hawaii's innovation economy, tune in to Bite Marks Cafe on Hawaii Public Radio HPR 1 today at 6:30 p.m.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii. R&B and pop singer Estelle from West London performs June 9th and 10th with songs such as American Boy and Come Over. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
What have we done? That was a reaction of a marine scientist and the first Micronesian woman to explore the deepest part of the Pacific Ocean. The Marianas Trench is more than 7 miles deep. Nicole Yamase's journey is detailed in a documentary that won the Pacifica Award at the Hawaii International Film Festival last year. We talked to Yamase and filmmaker Daniel Lin in January. Lin also works with Niatero, an organization focused on elevating the role and influence of indigenous people. He starts off talking about how the film, Remitau, People of the Ocean, came together.
Nicole has been living this story for her whole life, and it's a big reflection of her journey and her perspective. And for me, it's a culmination of many years and many relationships and that I've been fortunate enough to have and be a part of over the course of my work throughout the Pacific, especially in across the Micronesia region. And so when we came together and she had her experience and we understood like there's these bigger arcs of stories that are tied throughout the diaspora, the many generations of people that live across Hawaii and the mainland and also in all parts of Micronesia, we just felt like it was a really great opportunity to explore what that would look like through the lens of an individual like Nicole, who has such a unique perspective, but also a very powerful and charismatic voice, but ultimately look at a community story in that regard. So that's why we made it. It's our love letter to the people that have nourished and supported us across the region for so long.
And Nicole, talk about the experience, because they followed you around for an awful long time.
They did, and I'm so grateful for them, because in that moment, in those times, you don't realize, like Dan said, we didn't plan for this to go 4 years. And like I said, I'm very grateful to them, because I think these kinds of stories need time to really capture the big moments and low moments of life. But yeah, having them just following me around was weird. I definitely had to get used to it. But I'm grateful that they have all of this footage with my family, me doing field work, me collecting algae and meeting and speaking with the Remitau community and all of those. I'm so grateful, because now looking back, watching it, during the filming, I would sometimes get frustrated or just feel uncomfortable with the camera there. But now watching the film, I'm just so grateful that Dan and his team were there to just capture those beautiful moments, because you don't realize these special moments until you really step back and watch the film and be like, oh, okay, this was a moment that needed to be captured and shared with others.
Well, I was very jealous. I was very jealous that you got to go to the bottom of the Marianas Trench, because living in Guam and just learning about it was just always a mystery to me. And when you talked about the marine debris that was on the bottom there, miles deep, it was pretty startling.
Yes, I did not expect to see marine debris down there, especially in a moment where I'm just feeling so proud and so honored to be there and to just take it all in. And then when I see the tethers and the lines at the bottom, then I'm just, my whole mindset kind of just goes to disappointment and embarrassment of what have we done? It's seeing trash at the bottom is a huge red light going off in our faces. But we've already had so many red lights flashing in our faces, and yet we're still continuing what we're doing, just polluting our oceans.
When I think of island cultures and the matriarchal, I guess, viewpoint where we take care of our family and our home, and you want to take care of that debris and that rubbish down in the trench, but that's so far to go, and it just almost seems like an impossible task unless we stop it from getting down there in the first place.
Yeah, and just wonder how much trash. Can you imagine? We're at the bottom of Challenger Deep, and we stumble upon trash. How much trash is there, really? Even Dawn Wright, with the beer bottle she saw the following year, like, how much is down there and how long has it been there? And yeah, I think with the changing worlds and priorities, things shifting, currents moving and bringing in this trash, we really just need to shift our mindset to how life would be before. What would our ancestors say and do?
And Daniel, you work with Niatero, and that just that whole indigenous perspective of that organization, knowing that you've produced this film and have been able to tell this story, I don't know. How does that make you feel?
I feel in the world of being in the Pacific, and especially seeing the world and the lens and stories through Pacific peoples, there's nothing more sacred than ocean spaces. Right? Ocean spaces are the spaces that unite, that nourish, that connect people. They're the sea lanes of all of the previous voyagers. And so to think of what ancestral territory means for Pacific Islanders, you could say that the bottom of the ocean is just such a sacred space, especially one that, as deep as it is, it's a space where all creation legends come out of. It's this space where there's this immense amount of life, whether it's seen or unseen, felt or unfelt, it is just sacred. And so the feeling that that is disturbed by what happens on the surface in careless ways is what we wanted to highlight with this film, and just to show that the ocean is not this big kind of dumping ground. It's not it's not this vast, empty, vacuous space. It is it's this place full of life and memory and in of itself. And so we wanted to showcase that what happens, all of these things are interconnected from the top to the bottom.
When I think of the ocean, I think of what gives me strength, right? It powers us, it feeds us. We thrive in the ocean. And with the many threats, there's lots of talk about commercial fishing in some of these pristine areas, undersea mining, lots to guard against.
Yeah, absolutely. Like in the work of communities, coastal communities, indigenous communities all over the world who are guardians of their place. And within those spaces, some of the most special and most intact ecosystems are there. And they're a reminder of what the world, what the earth is and what it was and what it could be. And the ocean is no different, right? What we do to the ocean, if it changes its ecology, changes its, and it disturbs all of that living memory. And so I think doing the work of trying to shed light on how important it is, how important these spaces are, and how important it is to be guardians of our ocean space, is we're just a small part of doing that work. But hopefully storytelling and films like this can be a conversation starter for people who might have their eyes open to it.
And then anything else you want to add, Nicole, just about what happens now?
So now we're really with Remetau, and you've seen that there's so many different powerful levels of the story that can help shape our young minds. One of the big goals that we would like to do is build curriculum, help get the remetao into classrooms, into spaces where our kids and the youth can see who we are, how deep we are connected to the ocean, what can we do to take care of our sacred spaces. And through the work with One Reef like that, working with indigenous communities back home to bring back our traditional ways, knowledge, and perspective of the ocean so that those could be our North Star of what we do, to make sure that we're all aligned and that we come together to work together to protect and take care of our oceans.
I like that idea of guardians of the sea, or people of the ocean. And any final thoughts, Daniel, just about where you see this film going?
No, for us, it's really important that it's seen and across the islands, across the, especially across the Northern Pacific, and in Hawaii. We would love for it to be, we'd love to get it into kind of university campuses and into other film festivals. But mainly, we just want it to be this conversation starter. Because on many levels, this film asks many questions of our audience. And we're hoping that those questions lead to discussion and dialogue, and whether it's internal, whether it's in community, whether it's in the living room, whether it's in a theater, we really want people to ask, have these difficult conversations about what it means to be in the modern day stewards of place, stewards of culture, stewards of story, and hopefully we can move forward in these healthy discussions. I think that's very needed in Hawaii, but also all across the Pacific and all across the world.
That was Nicole Yamase and Daniel Lin. The film is titled Remetao, The People of the Ocean. It will be showing at the Dock Edge Festival in New Zealand this summer. We'll have links to upcoming in-person and virtual showings. You're tuned to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today, we are revisiting interviews with leaders on the front lines of climate change, hearing from Pacific Island Voices about their homes. We spoke with the climate envoy for the Marshall Islands back in March when she'd been named the Spring 2026 Dan and Maggie Inouye Distinguished Chair in Democratic Ideals. Kathy Jettner-Kirchner is a Marshallese poet and educator. She was born in the Marshall Islands and raised in Hawaii. She starts off reading a selection from her book, Iyipjatok, Poems from a Marshallese Daughter.
Magical Wudilomer at the south that grew from the reef itself. Its white petals fell into the water and blossomed into flying fish. On a lazy Sunday, my cousin Tamara and I lay side by side on my auntie Kaka's veranda, sun drying our skin. Together we dreamed of a place for young people like us, who leapt joyful into water, willing themselves wings to fly, who dared to dream of a world where islands stay rooted. I still nightmare of dead leather sharks, but I'd rather dream. I'd rather imagine our next generation, their voices turning the tides, how our freshwater lens will drink in their chants, how they will speak shark songs and fluent fish, how they will leap, petal soft, beautiful, unafraid, into the water before blossoming to fly.
That is powerful. And I think for people who grew up in islands, in island communities, just to, you know, you've got the cultural aspect, but then also the reality of what's happening now with climate change. And what got you down this path of writing as a political statement?
So I was trained in a poetry class called Poetry for the People at UC Berkeley. While I was going to school at Mills College, I did a cross-registration there. And it basically taught me about how a lot of people of color across communities have used poetry to speak to social justice movements, social issues and causes. And so that really taught me, well, what are my social justice issues? What's my community's issues? And at the time, they didn't have a section on Pacific Islander poetry, but we studied Chicano, Latino American poetry, we studied Arab American poetry, we studied Black poetry, poetry from Asian American authors. And, you know, I think learning all of that really taught me there's so much that poetry can actually do. It shouldn't just reflect a beautiful world, but also what we want to changes we want to see.
And so I think in a time where there are climate change deniers, why do you think the work that you do then is so important?
I think that's exactly how you said it, just the fact that there is so much denial going on, that we need to be louder than ever, which is easier said than done at the end of the day. You know, it's a tough environment we're in right now. And with so much geopolitical tensions and wars happening right now, it can be hard to care about something like climate change. You know, it can get subsumed in all of that, travesty, but it's all connected at the end of the day. So I do think it's really important to keep working on these issues, you know, and that's something very close to my heart and to my community. So it's part of the job.
And you go back and forth between the Marshalls and the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about that connection, because for folks who may not understand, right, I mean, the islands, their independence, the sovereignty, and yet all the political forces, the colonization of so many of our island nations out there.
Yeah, the Marshall Islands has a treaty with the United States called the Compact of Free Association. It's not just the Marshall Islands that has this arrangement. It's also Palau and the Federated States of Micronesia. So we are an independent country. We have a seat at the United Nations, but we're not a territory, so we don't. Actually, I'm not able to vote with the United States, and you know, we do have some level of independence from the United States, but I can also enter the country freely. And so, yeah, I have some family responsibilities that are in Oregon, so there's been times when I've had to make it work where I had to, yeah, go back and forth quite a bit. And there's quite a lot of Marshallese, actually, in the United States, too, the largest population being in Arkansas.
Yes, and it's fun when I go traveling across the country and I go to different airports. I was in Denver, and a young gentleman who helped me was from Chuuk. And he said, but I grew up in Guam. And it turns out we went to the same elementary school. You know? So it's that connection. And when you see so many islanders moving over to the continent and establishing roots there and integrating in those communities, but yet still holding tight to their culture.
Yeah, I would say so. There's so many Marshallese people who have made their own little communities out there. And I think Arkansas is definitely one of the biggest ones, but there's also large communities out in California and in Washington and Oregon also. So I think there's ways to keep our cultures really alive and thriving in these environments.
I was delighted to learn that there was a radio station there. And we connected with the general manager there during COVID because they were able to create a program with a Marshallese doctor who was educated here at the med school.
Dr. Sheldon Riglin.
And yes, and was able to talk to the Marshallese community on the radio about COVID. And it was just a wonderful, I don't know, moment in time to see those connections and the importance of keeping culture.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have so few doctors in our community who are incredibly involved in not just their practices, but also in community awareness and raising. And Dr. Sheldon Riglin is one of them. He's very well-known and does incredible work, as does my cousin, Dr. Wilfred Alec, is another one, too. And they do a lot of community activism. And because, you know, when you are Marshallese, you're not just your job. You're also a community member, and you have a lot of responsibilities that go beyond your title and position.
And so talk about that, growing up with that sense of responsibility.
I guess one quick reminder of that, or one throwback, is being told quite often that when I grew up, I had to find a position that would ultimately serve our community in some way, would give back. I was told quite often by my mother, you have a lot of privilege. There's a lot of privilege that you're growing up with, this access to education and access to other things. So you need to be able to find a way to give back. So that's always been in the back of my mind. And I think that's why poetry also, for me, wasn't just a solo venture, but also a way to engage with communities. There's some kind of community aspect to it. That's why a lot of my work also went into community organizing through the nonprofit my cousins and I co-founded together.
And so I think maybe share with our listeners what your mom does.
Yes. Yeah. My mother is in her second term as president of the Marshall Islands. She's the senator for Aur Atoll, one of the atolls in the Marshalls. And yeah, I think we're very proud of her. She does incredible work, and it's incredibly difficult work, especially during this time. But I think she's doing her best to navigate such delicate circumstances.
Yes, and I know there are many island groups that are built around a matriarchal society, and the women are the leaders of the family unit and the community. And it's important to acknowledge that, because on the Western, in the Western world, that's not always the case.
Yeah, I would say it's an incredible experience to see your mother, someone who you grew up with. You know, she worked in a nonprofit here in Hawaii for years. So I grew up out here from when I was 6 years old until I graduated at 18. And she worked at a nonprofit called Pacific Resources for Education and Learning, which was based here in Hawaii for many years.
PREL.
Yeah,
yes.
PREL. Exactly.
I'm very familiar with PREL.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And then she went back after we graduated, ran for senator, lost the first time she ran. Second time she ran, she won. And I think seeing her ascend to presidency is huge. You don't expect that from your mother, you know, that you grew up with. And I think also seeing someone who's older, in her kind of more autumn years, you might say, achieving something like that really teaches you about how things can change. It taught me about flipping over my expectations of what women are capable of, if you're not just the things that you can accomplish, basically. So I think witnessing and being a part of the history of her accomplishment has also influenced me very deeply.
Yeah, and then growing up here as well, that whole idea of kuleana, right? That just sense of great responsibility that you have.
I do think that's exactly the right term for it, kuleana. That, yeah, I think that's something I was very much raised with. I think that's something that's an integral part of most Islander cultures. And I would say it's definitely a part of Marshallese culture too. It's that sense of responsibility to not just yourself, but to your community.
And talk a minute about identity. Just because we have now so many people, young people from Micronesia, whose roots are in Micronesia, who are growing up in other places, whether you're from Guam and you're growing up in California, or from the Marshalls and spending time here, or in Oregon, or like the young man from Chuuk, who was, you know, learning about Denver, or like I said, Arkansas, or wherever people happen to land.
I think, you know, identity is so shifting, you know, it's very fluid. And I think I had that experience. I was someone that grew up in Hawaii that I ended up losing a lot of Marshallese language because I wasn't around a lot of other Marshallese young people. And then because I was told constantly, please, you know, you got to speak English, like you can do well in school and you want to get good grades. And then I went to college in California and that deteriorated further. So going back home after college was really crucial. If I hadn't gone back home, I don't know where I would be now. But I think going back home and reconnecting with home and reconnecting with culture and community, and when you're away for so long, sometimes you start to imagine and put on a pedestal your island and you sort of romanticize it a bit. And I think being at home for so many years has taught me how complex it actually all is. And I also had to relearn my language. So I guess I would say for all of those young people out there who might be struggling with identity and culture, like, it doesn't have to look like one specific way. I don't think a lot of Marshallese people expected a poet to come out of our community, but there are poets actually. They just look a little bit different. And I would also say it's possible to reconnect and to do that work, to relearn and to reconnect deeper and deeper. And I think it's worthwhile.
Living out here for so long in Hawaii, the one thing that I can do in my language is pray, you know, Hail Mary. But it's that kind of, I think, struggle with identity and culture. And when you're raised, speak English so that you can get a good job and survive and thrive in these changing geopolitical times. I think, you know, as you come back here to Hawaii, you're now in this unique position to share your mana'o, to share and bare your soul about culture and what's happening in your island home. What do you want to do in this next year?
I mean, I just completed my doctorate, and it was called Arkabidunen, Climate Adaptation Policy and Poetry in the Marshall Islands. So it is basically an analysis of our climate adaptation policies. And there's a lot that we're doing right now on climate change. And that's basically my entire role as climate envoy for our Marshallese government is, you know, representing my country at climate change meetings, working on negotiations, and also supporting our team in developing policy. All of that, you know, just sounds very straightforward, but there's a lot I'm processing throughout all of this, and I definitely miss creative work and am looking forward to hopefully being able to direct a little bit more attention to processing what I've been working on and creating something out of that. I think I'd like to work on some books, basically, and writing.
That was Climate Envoy for the Marshall Islands, Kathy Jetno-Kiltner. Her book, Iep Jeltok, Poems from a Marshallese Daughter is available at Native Books in Chinatown and online. Coming up, we feature a rising star in environmental law who's dedicated his career to defending the rights of indigenous peoples. We'll have more from our Pacific Islander Hana Hosho after a break.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Pacific Health. Straub Benioff Medical Center's urgent care clinics are committed to providing care for minor illnesses and injuries. HawaiiPacificHealth.org/urgent care.
HPR is a unifier, a place where we can come together to stay informed, learn about our world, and experience music that feeds the soul. You can secure this resource for future generations when you include HPR in your will or estate plan. It's a simple but profound way to give, and an enduring investment in the future of this station. For more information about giving a gift through your will, visit hawaiipublicradio.org/legacy.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Olson Trust, envisioning a Hawaii where its people are supported by the land, and the land is taken care of by its people. OlsonTrust.com.
Julian Uggan is a fellow Chamorro, a native of Guam, what used to be known as Guahan. Uggan comes from a place where he's using his skills as a writer and a lawyer to tackle issues of environmental justice tangled in complicated political history. He wrote the book No Country for Eight Spot Butterflies, a collection of essays that covers resistance, resilience, and collective power. He vividly remembers the day that sent him on the path as a human rights advocate.
Basically, in 2005, the U.S. federal government came out with an announcement that it had sort of unilaterally decided to heavily militarize my homeland, which is Guam, as you know, our homeland. And there was no meaningful consultation. There's no consultation whatsoever, actually. And so we had constantly, in 2005, 2006, in that one-year window, we just kept hearing announcement after announcement. You know, these are announcements that were really sort of thrown to us, flung at us from on high, you know, from the decision maker, those in power. And I realized this is why I need to go to law school. This precise reason, you know, I was tired of being talked out of the room by lawyers. I was tired of sort of the U.S. federal government and other sort of, you could say, nefarious actors who were really, like, you know, private corporations who were really, you know, benefiting from militarization, like the military buildup of Guam, these projects. I was like, they had been weaponizing the law, you know, and doing it in such a way. I'll just give you a really concrete example. The U.S. Department of Defense spent years creating this environmental impact assessment, like millions of dollars, tons of contracted experts. And then they gave the community of Guam, my people, 45 days to respond. Then they had, you know, the grace to extend it to a 90-day comment period. But it was insane. The scale of the military buildup of Guam then planned was staggering, and it still is. And so I really wanted to go to law school precisely because I wanted to do the opposite thing with law. I wanted to embark on a very different kind of project, which is, you know, using language and the language of the law to clarify my intent, not to cloud it, you know, and to sort of deploy it on behalf of vulnerable communities like my own, the indigenous Chamorro people of Guam. And I guess you could say my work as a writer is similar, if not the same in some ways. It's still fundamentally about interrogating language, its use, what types of actors are using language in what type of ways, you know? So the way our community on the ground, our activists are using language is very, very different from the way, for example, various U.S. federal agencies that are trying to effectively give waivers to the U.S. military to imperil a whole host of life, both on land and at sea. So that project, I've been involved in that project for a lot longer. You know, Jen, that is just my work as a writer, but to answer your first question about Guam, Guam is just an incredibly beautiful place, as you know. It's roughly 30 miles long. It's the ancestral homeland of the indigenous Chamorro people. We've been there for well over 3,000 years. We have a matrilineal society. We have a very elaborate system of cultural values, the center of which I would argue is the ethos of reciprocity. We actually have more words for reciprocity than any other word in our language, which gives some indication about the kinds of values, you know, we have as a people. And so we've thrived in this particular place for thousands of years, and that place is in danger.
It's been a year since you published a book about a native species. Share with our listeners about that particular butterfly.
Sure. So the butterfly in question is the Mariana eight-spot butterfly. She's native to Guam. She is an emphalid butterfly, so she's orange and black, essentially, in color. And she's incredibly resilient. You know, I like to say that so many people who are so much more familiar with the monarch butterfly were such big fans, aside from the beauty, just of the resilience. I think the monarch butterfly has to go through 5 larval instars to really sort of step into her power and become a full-fledged butterfly. But our Mariana eight-spot butterfly, in fact, goes through 6 larval instars. So I think she's like a testament, you know, to the importance of respecting strength as opposed to power. And that's why, to me, she's such an emblematic figure for our movement on Guam. I mean, we have survived, like her, or my people, Chamorro people, have survived hundreds of years of uninterrupted colonization, the harms of which are still ongoing and really concretely being felt today. And now that sort of enduring colonial enterprise is being exacerbated by a very hyper-aggressive round of militarization.
And so, you know, when you wrote this book and you were a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize Award, what did that mean to you?
From a very personal perspective, you know, the book was most meaningful because I saw that it really brought so many people together. Like when I went on a national book tour last year, this time last year, in fact, I had been going to New York, San Francisco, Seattle, here too. But no matter where I went, I saw large groups of particularly young Chamorro people, young Chamorro members of the diaspora, so-called, because they don't live at home, right? They feel a certain loss and a certain mahaling, like a deep longing to be with each other. And I saw, like, for example, several WhatsApp groups created. I watched firsthand all these, like, young Chamorros who even worked as close as one New York City block from each other and didn't even know each other. They didn't know of each other's existence. So I saw this bring people together in just in really beautiful ways. And I saw it build community. And that's what I think the most we could ever ask from a book is, to build community. You know, that is, it's, you know, deeply loving, you know, and that is like all we can really do, especially in the times we're living in now. These are, you know, very trying times. And so people, we need each other. And this book helped do that. Another thing I'll say is I thought it was really interesting, maybe perhaps arguably the most special aspect of it, is the book is primarily about grief. In the book, I'm processing a whole host of loss, including, you know, the loss of my father from pancreatic cancer when I was 9 years old. So the book really uses grief, but it tries to do it in a much more indigenous way, where it's not grief that has an isolating effect, you know, which is a very individualistic kind of like walling off, you know, of oneself from others and people from each other. Instead, this is like, you know, Angela Davis, she once said, walls turned sideways are bridges. Grief is like that. So like, I try to turn grief on its side and allow people to, like, it almost functions like a bridge. And like, through our grief, we can find each other again, you know? It means a lot to me.
And so the fact that you have been able to build community through this book, through the young Chamorros that are transplanted, mm-hmm. you know, across the continent. You just learned of this development, you know, and I know there had been some challenges to this buildup.
Yeah, definitely. There's been a number of challenges, legal and otherwise. I mean, we even had allies here like Earth Justice file lawsuits on our behalf. I have filed lawsuits, you know, on behalf of the people with my firm. We were successful in some. For example, we successfully sued Fish and Wildlife to protect critical habitat for a number of species. But of course, it's not enough, you know, and the U.S. federal courts suffer from this very particular kind of ailment, if you will. They allow, you know, U.S. federal courts tend to allow certain prudential doctrines, like the political question doctrine, which functions to essentially remove the possibility of judicial review from cases that the judicial branch feel that the Constitution textually commits to the coordinate political branches. So that's a problem, right? So essentially, as long as the U.S.'s military is the actor and it claims national security and it claims to need a firing range, you know, environmental laws be damned is essentially the point. So instead of just like sort of bringing a simple case, you know, under the Endangered Species Act or under the National Environmental Policy Act, all of these federal environmental laws that were passed to protect the exact species that are in danger now, you know, you see, you know, Fish and Wildlife or NOAA coming out and sort of effectively giving waivers, you know, sort of excusing the U.S. military's performance or compliance with these obligations, you know, and it's just the state of affairs that we're in. In some ways, it's a very accurate state or accurate reflection of the fact that the U.S. military is still proceeding in ways that are really ecologically destructive, and they're getting the legal license to do so.
Do you feel like they are treating our native species as second-class species? No. I mean, Guam is a territory. It's not a state. And you would like to think that those laws apply evenly.
At the heart of all of this is a glaring denial of the fundamental right of self-determination for the people of Guam. We are still recognized by the United Nations as a non-self-governing territory, which is a fancy way of saying colony. So we are formally slated for some future act of decolonization at which we will be able to choose one of three internationally recognized political status options, which includes a right to outright independence. So yes, we have all of these rights under international law, but the U.S. is sort of flagrantly violating those rights. You know, and it is sad. I mean, and that's just from an international perspective. Under U.S. law, Guam remains an unincorporated territory, as you say. What that means is, you know, it means many things. But actually, what it really means, if you want to be simple about it, it just gives U.S. Congress sort of carte blanche, so-called plenary power, to do whatever it wishes with the territories, including act in ways that are disparate, unfair, unequal, inequitable, unjust. And all of that sort of has constitutional blessing because the enduring legacy of the insular cases, which is, right, the turn of the century sort of legal fiction that was devised by the U.S. Supreme Court to basically allow the U.S. to exercise this sort of unfettered power over the overseas colonial possessions it took over from Spain at the conclusion of the Spanish-American War without, in turn, conferring rights upon the citizens, the native inhabitants of those territories. So, of course, over history, we've gained certain rights incrementally, and certain constitutional provisions apply incrementally. But it's always subject to complete defeasance by Congress. What yep. Congress gives, it can take away.
And it is still considered by many in the military to be an outpost.
Oh, yes. I mean, definitely. Military uses language like that to almost disappear all the people living there.
That was Julian Uggen, a writer and a lawyer. This conversation originally aired in 2023. You can find his book, No Country for Eight-Spot Butterflies, by checking the links on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Last year, Uggen was one of four changemakers around the world to win the Swedish Right Livelihood Foundation's annual award. That's it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, he was the youngest swimmer to tackle the 26-mile Ka'iwi Channel. It was a record that held for years, now broken. Call our talkback line and give us your feedback, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can listen back to our shows on our website, and you can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and Kevin Allen, with support from the HPR digital team. The Backyard Quiz theme, written for us by John DeMello, our theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.